What's up, everybody? You've got Megan and Sim today on the podcast episode. Welcome to Student Loan Planner, where we're going to talk about all things student loan questions today, questions from the inbox. Let's kick it off, Sim, with maybe a fun fact about you. What is a favorite holiday tradition since we're coming up on the holidays?
Yeah. So in my house, we celebrate both Hanukkah and Christmas. And so our Christmas tree, I call it like a very large Hanukkah bush. So basically I do Hanukkah colored ornaments on my Christmas tree. So silver, blue, it's very thematic. And we kind of just combine all those traditions together.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
It's like merging the two. That's cool. In a beautiful way. Awesome.
How about you?
So my dad's side of the family, we like to do a breakfast for Christmas. We don't always do it on Christmas Day because there's still some young ones in the family where they spend Christmas at home. But maybe the day after, like the weekend of Christmas or something, we'll do a Christmas breakfast at my grandma's house. And we're all supposed to wear our pajamas when we show up.
Oh, that's cute. Is it all flannel?
Yeah, mostly flannel. Everybody's got flannel, you know, or something like silly onesies or something. So it's fun. And then one year we decided, I can't remember why, we decided not to do the pajamas or for whatever reason, but my sister did not get that memo. So she showed up like full blown, like Christmas onesie. Like she's nice. The only one walking into Christmas breakfast with her pajamas on. It was pretty good.
That's a cool tradition.
Yeah. Well, cool. Well, I think today we thought we'd start to go through some common questions we're starting to see more and more of in the Facebook groups and in our Student Loan Planner inbox, and with some case studies that we've been walking through just in our one-on-one consultations, some common trends we're starting to see. So let's maybe kick it off with some of the Facebook questions that we're seeing most regularly. Sim is kind of sorting through the PSLF Physicians Facebook group that we have. And I was sorting through the PSLF eligible teachers and school admin group. People are very active in these groups, which is great. And I think people do have really great feedback on like their timelines and how they've been going through their own PSLF process. There's also questions in there not totally PSLF related, but I think the majority of the questions are PSLF related. So we'll start with this and then we could spin over to our inbox if that works for you.
All right. Well, let's kick it off with a question that we got from the physicians group. So this person wants to know if they are working 70% full time, does that count for PSLF? The answer is maybe after July. So under normal PSLF rules, the definition of full time is either what your employer defines as full time or a minimum of at least 30 hours a week, whichever is greater. Under the new proposed rules for PSLF, they will allow full-time, just a flat definition, 30 hours a week. So as long as you're working 30 hours a week, doesn't really matter what percent full-time you're considered. At that point, it'll count. So that'll be a nice change for a lot of people who maybe are working like per diem, work, you know, multiple jobs, kind of combine that together and get your full-time equivalent there.
Yeah. And what I've told in consultations too, it does come down to whatever the employer will sign off on. So if you're 0.7 time, you know, FTE, does the employer still consider you full-time enough to where they would check that box and sign it off or sign off for you on the employment certification form? But yeah, there's going to be a lot more clarity, but it's going to be more simple here coming up in July, thankfully. So yes. If you're not technically eligible now, your employer won't sign off on that. You could be starting July when that definition changes. Awesome. Well, one question I saw over and over again is about refunded overpayments or refunds in general. So just a refresh right now during the COVID forbearance, if you have federal student loans, you can request a refund for any payments you've made since March 13th, 2020. And that's for anyone, not just PSLF folks, but if you made chunks of payments since March of 2020, you can go back and ask for a refund. Those going towards forgiveness, that definitely makes sense because we don't want to pay when we're already getting free credit towards PSLF or the 20 or 25 year forgiveness. And then for PSLF folks, you can get refunded for overpayments through the PSLF waiver. So if you made well above 120 payments, that's the requirement for PSLF. Through the PSLF waiver, you should be getting a refund of overpayments. So it does look like some people have started to get checks in the mail. One question was, has anyone actually been refunded for overpayments? What does that process look like? So the process, it should be automatic for PSLF purposes. If you're someone who's not pursuing PSLF or you're not getting an overpayment, but you want to just ask for payments that you made back, you will have to call the loan servicer and request this specifically. But some of the responses were that people have been getting checks in the mail and getting paid in full letters within a couple of weeks from that as well. But I know you had a story you wanted to tell.
I do. And I also have a question for you. Let me ask the question and we'll tell the story. Question is, does this refund apply for people who had FFELP loans that they consolidated into direct loans?
They do not. Only direct federally held student loans can be eligible for the refund. That's a great question. So if you had FFELP loans that you consolidated to correct for PSLF or for this IDR waiver coming up, the payments that you had made on the FFELP loans before, unfortunately, you cannot get a refund for them because they weren't the right loan type at the time. But you can get a refund if for whatever reason, after the consolidation happened, if you started making payments after that, then you can get a refund on the payments that you made on the direct consolidation loan, but not the FFELP.
Awesome. Yeah, let me share my little story as far as refunds go. So I share on the podcast before, you know, my husband has student loans, and back in 2020, we were making extra payments. We probably made an extra like $2,000 in payments before we decided, you know, this isn't really one of our financial priorities. Let's do something else. But because of the CARES Act, back in August, we called Mohela, which is his servicer, and requested the refund like everyone else. And they said 30 days, which ended up now we're at 90. Now we're past 90 days, still no refund. Mohela told us, well, go ahead and call the Department of Treasury because apparently they're the ones who have to do this refund. Well, okay. I call the Department of Treasury. I'll play ball. Couldn't get through to anybody. Their phone tree, though, is not as bad as Mohela's, but still, you couldn't get a live person there. And the other problem with Mohela, if you've tried to get a refund, if you've sat through their phone tree, is that if you press the button for the refund, they have an automatic response, basically, that if you overpaid and you were going to get a refund with like the Biden-Harris cancellation, you're going to get that automatically. And then the whole thing just hangs up on you, right? So basically, you're not getting a refund until the Biden-Harris cancellation is figured out and it's in court right now. And who knows if that's going to work out. And I don't think that's good enough. That's not good enough for me. I don't think that's good enough for borrowers. That's your money that could be sitting in a high yield savings account that you can do anything else with. So I decided to reach out to my congressperson's constituent services office and file a complaint, because I couldn't get through to anybody. And this is what I tell people all the time. If you have an issue with your student loans, there are different avenues. There's different people that you can contact. There's your, like I mentioned, your congressperson's constituent services office. You can try, you know, the student loan ombudsman, even though I've heard that they're pretty backed up. You can also try the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. So all of those are options that exist for you if you have any issues with anything. But I chose to do the constituent services because I've worked with them before. You know, that's what your tax dollars are going to. Like, this is someone who's elected to represent you and kind of go on your behalf between government agencies. So I don't have an update yet because I just did this last week, but that's what I have for you. If you have any complaints, you know, advocate for yourself. This is your money.
Mm-hmm. You'll have to keep us updated on the progress of that. So to maybe break it down in just really simple steps, what should someone do if they do need to maybe go this route?
Figure out who your congressperson is. You can also do your senator, but I decided to go like super local because I figured that would be more likely to get a response. So figure out who your congressperson is, and you can just literally type in Google like your congressperson's name and constituent services. And then you fill out a form basically explaining what happened. And the more information you have, usually the better, if you can provide like, you know, dates. I called on this day. I sent this thing. I did this payment. Whatever your issue is, if you can provide documentation, because usually there's also, not only do you get to fill out, you type out like what happened, they also have like an upload section where you can provide supporting documentation. Mm-hmm. So you kind of go through all that, make sure you're the, you know, right person, you're the legal person to fill that out. And then it's pretty easy.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Well, yeah, keep us posted on that.
I will.
I love that you are an advocate, of course, for yourself. And then, of course, for our borrowers listening who might need to go that route. So thank you.
Yeah, it's nice to report back. So that's part of why I do it.
Okay. So next question I got is a common question I've been seeing in all Facebook groups, also in our inboxes, but I got a payment count today from Ohila. The letter says it's PSLF and TEPSLF. Has anyone gotten a first letter saying it's both counts, but then later got a letter with more qualifying payments? My numbers seem very low, and I've been getting this email time and time again. I know we've talked about this on the podcast, but we'll talk about it again just to scream it from the rooftops. Payment counts, they are doing in batches. Why? I don't know. But it seems like they're processing PSLF, the employment certification forms, using the original PSLF rules first. Then they're coming back in and doing the PSLF waiver, but maybe not completely doing the PSLF waiver all at once. They're doing even that in batches, maybe by time period or by employment. I can't really tell the rhyme or reason between like why they count certain payments when and when they do the next batch. But that is definitely what we're seeing across the board, is you won't just get one final, you know, payment count update, unfortunately. It'll come in multiple updates. So if you get the first, maybe even the second payment count update from Ohila, it looks a little low, don't panic. There are going to be some more coming. You can always check your progress on exactly which time periods by the month that they're counting and that they've counted so far with your PSLF payment tracker that's within Mohila's portal. So if you don't have a portal with Mohila yet because you just got moved over there, make sure to create a portal, an online login. And then under the PSLF section, there's like a tab at the top. You'll click PSLF. At the very bottom, there will be a PSLF payment tracker that you can click on, and it'll break it down by eligible payments, ineligible payments. It'll tell you why something hasn't been qualified yet. If it shows employment not certified, but you know you've submitted an employment certification form for that time period, know that that will be updated soon, and that might be on the next batch that's coming up. That just means that they haven't looked at it or they haven't matched up your employment certification form with those months yet. Anything you'd like to add to that?
I think that's pretty spot on. And I would say that this week, that's probably the number one question I've been getting in my inbox from people is about payment counts not being updated, or like they're getting an update, but it doesn't have everything. It just has those partial counts. So I would say, yeah, exactly what you said, Megan, that they're doing it in batches for no really good reason that we can understand.
Yeah, I cannot understand it. And it does seem like they're prioritizing folks that might already be over 120 payments. So if you're someone who is just submitting documentation to get a payment count update, you're probably going to be lower on the totem pole for getting an update soon. And it could be as late as July is what they're saying. But you've been telling folks like to expect at least 4 months, right?
4 months at a minimum.
Yeah. And it could be faster. We have seen folks get it done sooner for whatever reason. It's just, I wish there was like a formula to it, but there's not.
And back to kind of the advocating for yourself piece, if you feel like it's been even longer, if it's maybe been like 6 months and you're just not getting anywhere, you can do a reconsideration request or go through one of those channels I mentioned and file a complaint.
Yes, the reconsideration application or like online system, it is live. If especially use this if you feel like they have not counted payments, they've told you that certain months are not eligible. If you feel like they should be, or if they came back and told you that your employer is not eligible when you know that they are, that is what that reconsideration process is for. So go ahead and submit that. You could just Google PSLF reconsideration and it'll take you right to the application.
Another thing that we're noticing, so with the PSLF waiver, a lot of people were consolidating their loans to turn them in, you know, from those ineligible FFELP or Perkins loans into direct loans. And even now, some people are still consolidating because of the IDR waiver. A question that I've been getting from a few people is actually from the application itself and the fine print. The fine print has not been updated with the language of either the PSLF waiver when it still existed or the IDR waiver. And so it still has that old language where it's all scary and it says, if you consolidate, your payment's going to start over. But the waiver supersedes that. So just kind of for your peace of mind, we have been seeing people getting their loans forgiven with the waiver who did consolidations. Their payment counts maybe temporarily were set to zero because of, you know, an internal whatever reason. Just know that that's temporary. And by consolidating, you're not actually going to restart your payment count to zero as long as we have the IDR waiver currently. Mm-hmm.
I think this next question I had branches off from this. And then there was a case study I thought we could mention that is also tied into this. So another question I saw, or I keep seeing too, is I've submitted information to consolidate my loans maybe 2 to 3 months ago. I haven't heard anything. What should my next steps be? So a couple of things here. If you applied to consolidate maybe back when the PSLF waiver was going on before the October 31st deadline, or you've done so recently, if you haven't gotten any correspondence, go back and make sure you got some kind of confirmation when you think you had done the application. Because as soon as you submit a consolidation application, you get a letter or an email from studentaid.gov, from FSA, that says, hey, we received your application. You may have had additional steps that you needed to take. And this is in regards to those who are married. So if you consolidated and you applied for an income-driven plan, that confirmation letter would say, hey, we got your consolidation application. You're almost done. So you do need to pay attention to that. What the next step is going to be is that your spouse is going to need to sign off on your not technically your consolidation application, but the income-driven application that was part of that. So if your spouse does not have an FSA account, they can create one. That sounds kind of silly, but it is the only way they can electronically sign off on your income-driven applications in the future. So go ahead and create an account for your spouse. If you are going through the consolidation process, or if you did already and it doesn't seem like it got processed, it's probably because of this reason. And then your spouse will have a reference number or a cosign code to use to plug into the application to sign off on this. So that letter, or that, I keep saying letter, but that email you'll get right after you submit the application will give you all the details that you need to know on how you need to have your spouse sign off on it. And that should get the application completely submitted. If you're in the shoes of this person where you saw the confirmation email come through, it did have those extra steps that you did not take, you might need to contact the loan servicer that you consolidated with or that you sent the consolidation to see if they need anything else from you. And it's probably going to be the income-driven application spousal signature.
And I actually have one more point on consolidations as far as questions mm-hmm. we've been getting. This week, I got a wonderful email from someone we met with a few months ago, or not even a few months ago, just last month. And she told me that her loans were forgiven, right? And my first thought was, that was really fast, mm-hmm. like for Mohela. That was way too fast. But if she says her loans are forgiven, maybe they just did something out of order. So, you know, I congratulated her and then heard back like the next day saying, just kidding. Oh. It was just showing a $0 balance, but my balance is there now. So basically, here's what happened with her. And she will get her loans forgiven. She just has to wait probably 4 months like everyone else. What happened was she needed to do a consolidation to be eligible, right, with the PSLF waiver. And the consolidation just hadn't settled yet. And so if you think your loans are forgiven, but you're not sure, what you should look out for is an official letter from Mohela, because mm-hmm. they will send you a letter saying something like, congratulations, you've reached mm-hmm. 120 payments, your loans have been forgiven. Even if they haven't updated your payment, your balance to zero, you'll still get that official letter. So until you get that letter, hang tight.
Yep, that's a good point. That also can happen if you're just moving servicers. So it happens with consolidations because they're bundling the loans up, pulling them over to Mohela. But also if you've submitted an employment certification form, or you're someone who is getting moved from maybe Great Lakes to Nelnet, for example, with that Nelnet merger, it's possible that your loans could kind of disappear temporarily, where you can't see it on studentaid.gov. You're not really sure where they are at the point, or maybe you get like a paid off notice or letter. That could be very temporary. It's because of that transition. Usually it doesn't last longer than a couple of days, maybe a week at the most, from what we've been seeing from clients and from folks that have told us about it. But that is a good point, is, you know, if you're banking on the forgiveness, wait for that official letter. That is the confirmation that you'll need to know that that's exactly what's happening. Otherwise, you might just be in a transfer.
Yeah, I feel like it's almost like winning the lottery and you start spending your money before you got the check.
Oh, yeah. Your client, though, is really close. So it's like a tease.
Fortune. Yeah.
Okay. Well, one case study I thought would be applicable to this conversation about consolidations too, and public service loan forgiveness, and to the podcast episode me, you, and Rob had done about the backdoor PSLF waiver. I had a case last week where this person realized that they did have some nonprofit employment history on their undergraduate loans. They worked for maybe 3 years, let's say, an undergraduate school, made payments on their loans since they had undergraduate loans, and then they went to med school. So they went into in-school deferment, finished up their degree, went back into to residency, which is they were working at a nonprofit entity. They're currently working at an eligible employer now for PSLF. And they scheduled a consultation because they were trying to figure out, should I continue with PSLF? Because they were kind of toying with a private sector option. This person had almost almost 7 years of credit without the undergrad history already banked. And so I was looking at the file like, you wouldn't have happened to have worked, you know, in public service for undergrad, did you? Or with your undergrad loans? And he's like, actually, I did. I'm like, wait a second. You could be really close to PSLF then. So the conversation was, okay, well, with the PSLF waiver, we knew for a fact that you could consolidate. What would happen is the loan with the highest payment count towards PSLF would be applied to the whole consolidation. So before October 31st, it would have been a no-brainer to consolidate because they would have been, you know, 3 years closer to forgiveness for the whole enchilada, their whole balance. But I paused because we're past the October 31st deadline. The PSLF waiver is ended. I'm doing quotes because it technically is still open in a sense with the IDR waiver. So the IDR waiver right now says that you can consolidate and they're going to count payments prior to consolidations towards PSLF and income-driven repayment forgiveness. So I was staring at that line in the language, but then I was looking at what's to come starting July 1 with the changes to PSLF, where they're going to start taking the weighted average of payment counts for loans that have different payment counts. So we talked about that on the call. I was thinking, you know, okay, so I think it makes sense to consolidate, because I think the PSLF waiver is technically still available with this IDR waiver language. Worst case, maybe you get the average, the weighted average. And I think that's what you said too, because I threw it to the consultant team to check my like mindset. I was like, hang on, I need to talk this through with the group. And I think that's what you were saying too.
Yeah, I'm of the mindset that it's not going to start to zero, because that line that you pulled, and it's still there, even when they changed their website temporarily, it still said that payments made prior to consolidation will count. Mm-hmm. And they were pretty clear that this weighted average thing was going to start in July. And so I think that we're still kind of in PSLF waiver land here. I think that you will get the highest payment count. Obviously, we can't promise that to anyone because they still haven't given us an FAQ. Mm-hmm. But that's my interpretation of the language. And, you know, when we do like modeling here with consults here at Student Loan Planner, I always like to look at best case and worst case scenario. And so as it pertains to consolidations, for a lot of people, your worst case is, what if my payment count starts at zero? And so I'll look at that, right? And then we'll look at your best case. And for a lot mm-hmm. of people, what I've seen is that even if your worst case happens and your payment count does start over, for many people, it still makes sense to do the consolidation. It still puts mm-hmm. them in a better position based on the plan that we work out. Now, it's not for everybody, but, you know, for a lot of people, it makes sense to not have those FFELP loans anymore.
Yeah. And I think for him, his situation, I think the worst case is he's just at where he's at. You know, the payment count is not rounded up. Maybe there's not a weighted average. And that was where he thought he was anyways. So I think the best case is they do round up to the highest payment count, and he's within a year of PSLF when he called thinking that, you know, he might be going private sector in a couple of years because he likes his job enough. And so that's what I asked him too. I wanted to know, you know, would you stick around if you were within a year of PSLF? And he said, absolutely. It was just maybe 3 or 4 years that I was starting to think maybe private sector, like this job, there was a job enticing him. So, but those are the conversations we'll have. And we lay out all the pros and cons. And I think ultimately he's going to do the consolidation, and we'll confirm what that's going to look like here soon. Another case, an interesting case, I'm just like thinking off the top of my head now. I had another meeting yesterday, actually, another consultation yesterday, where this person is PSLF eligible. but they had one single FFEL loan, just one. And it was for a really small amount, small-ish. It was about $4,000 that was on the FFEL loan. So my first thought was, okay, this person probably needs to consolidate too, to convert that FFEL loan. And then in my mind, I was thinking, well, what is that going to mean for their payment though? Because when you consolidate, it does make you update your income. And so we talked through that on the consultation, and it ultimately made sense not to consolidate that FFEL loan to be eligible for PSLF, because the rest of her balance was, and that was the vast, vast majority of it. And if we had to update her income, her payment was based off of like a residency salary from 2018. So it would have really skyrocketed her payment if we were to consolidate and update the payment amount. So we did the math to figure out, does it make sense to consolidate this $4,000 loan? And the answer was ultimately no, because it would make her payment closer to $3,000. So it would defeat the purpose of it. It just mathematically wouldn't make sense. That just goes to show that like there's no cookie cutter case. There's really not. And it's completely dependent on so many different factors. And I think that's what's so fun about our consultations. Like, and for us, I think our planning minds, we like the puzzle to put it together. But yeah, that's a good example of how we might make one decision for one situation that would not be the right decision for somebody else's situation, which is in a similar boat. But
I'm actually so glad to hear you say that, because the last meeting I had was someone who had commercially held FFEL loans, and we also decided not to consolidate. And I was, at first I'm like, am I insane here? Because this is like a loan type that I'm like, this is a loan type that I've come to like know and hate and encourage people to consolidate out of. But mm-hmm. for her, it didn't make sense. She's going to end up paying this thing off. And she was very intimidated by the consolidation. She didn't need to do it.
Yeah. So sometimes that's also the right decision. It's just so fascinating. Like I was going through my head on like how many different factors we kind of run through in our head. I wonder if it's similar. This might be a silly comment because I'm obviously not in the medical field, but like for an ER person, someone working in the ER, they have to kind of go down a list when someone comes in on what they need to check for if someone is like unresponsive. So in our sense, in our very not as serious sense, when we do our planning, we kind of do that checklist too. We're like, okay, what are the things we need to check for? What are the things that could affect this? So I kind of think about that when I'm doing my planning.
We can call it financial triage.
Yeah, exactly.
There you go.
All right, cool. Well, I think we talked about some good case studies that we've saw recently that tied into some of the questions we've been getting about consolidation. One other question we've been getting a lot of is, hey, since everything's been tied up in the court system with forgiveness, does that mean my PSLF forgiveness or my IDR forgiveness path is at stake or at risk? And the answer is no. Those are completely separate things. The one-time cancellation is the only thing that's on maybe the chopping block that has to be decided in Supreme Court here coming up. But that has no implications or no effect to the ability to get public service loan forgiveness or the income-driven longer-term forgiveness. So I do want to clear that up so people aren't worried about that.
That's a good point. And speaking of forgiveness, some things that we've heard from people are about their drop in credit score when they get forgiveness or have, you know, part of their balance go away. So when you have your credit score, there's different components that go into making your credit score. You have like credit utilization, age of credit. What else, Megan?
There's also the types of credit you have, the history, payment history. And that's actually the biggest impact to credit score, on time, in full monthly payments. You said credit utilization, mm-hmm. new credit. I think we got them all. There's five main categories.
Usually like how much credit you have like available to you.
That's a combination of utilization rate and types of credit.
Yes.
Yeah. So types of credit, that's about 10% of what makes up your credit score. Credit history makes up about 10% generally. Utilization makes up about 30%. Payment history is 35%.
That's a big one.
Yeah, that is the biggest. And that's actually how your student loans can improve or maintain good credit, is if we're making payments on time and in full. We've been in this weird environment, though, where we haven't had payments for so long, but the student loans should not be negatively affecting your credit with the COVID forbearance that was specifically discussed and that was supposed to be the case for federal student loans. It, the credit bureaus were instructed not to negatively ding people for this time period. But yes, you're exactly right. When your balance falls off, you know, that's been forgiven, it shows as paid in full or paid as agreed and paid as in full. It does affect that kind of Rubik's cube of credit where it no longer has payment history to be tracking on that specific debt. It's a type of credit that you no longer have, and it can affect your age of credit too, because it's no longer a type of credit that you have. So it, that's why credit is kind of complicated, because it, there's so many different factors to credit that can affect your credit score at different weights, depending on your complete credit makeup. But moral of that story is, if you have a slight dip to your credit because of your balance being forgiven, you know, rebound pretty quickly. So don't panic. It will rebound with all of the other things that you have on your credit, as long as you're maintaining good credit in your other areas.
Yeah, it's definitely not a reason to skip out on forgiveness.
Yeah, no, definitely not. And also, if you're not planning on purchasing a house or a car right this moment, credit is really just a number. It tells lenders how good of a borrower you are. So it's especially important when you're buying a home or financing something. But if that's not something that you're doing right now, then that's not a huge factor, or it shouldn't be a huge like concern, I would say. There was one more case study I had that I wanted to touch on that deals with Parent PLUS loans, but were there any other questions you thought we should get to before we do that and wrap up?
I think we got through all the most commonly asked ones.
Awesome. Don't hesitate to join one of the Facebook groups as well. The ones we're talking about are more PSLF based, but I'm sure there's other groups out there that you could join for just sharing war stories, I guess you could say, with timelines or asking questions, answering questions. If you feel like you could maybe share more about your progress to maybe help someone else with their questions that they have. Yeah, don't hesitate to join those groups. Okay, so let's go into a Parent PLUS conversation, and then I think we'll wrap up with that today. We may have I think we'll probably do a Parent PLUS podcast episode maybe in 2023. If you want to do it with me, Sim, maybe we'll do it together.
Yes. Honestly, I think of Parent PLUS loans as like the orphan of student loans. Like they always get left out of everything. They're ignored. They're complicated.
Oh, yep, they are. So Parent PLUS loans, this is a federal loan that can be lent to a parent of a student going to undergraduate school. It cannot be borrowed for graduate school. They are under the name of the parent when they're borrowed. And if they stay in the federal system, they have to stay under the name of the parent. So sometimes that's a misconception that if you borrow a Parent PLUS loan, you could move it to the kid, you know, when they graduate in the federal system. And that is not true. You can move it to the child if you were to refinance later, privatize the loan into the name of the student. That's a decision you would have to make post-graduation for the student. They'd have to have good credit, a job to show income. So that's an option, but not in the federal system. So we do a lot of planning with Parent PLUS borrowers for a number of reasons. I think Parent PLUS borrowers they do tend to be older in the older generation because they're paying for their kids. So that means that they're coming up on retirement sooner. And they may have some pretty scary balances on these Parent PLUS loans that they're looking at while they're also looking at retirement. And they're trying to figure out, how do we do both? How do we, you know, I was planning on retiring at this age or this year. How does this student loan situation affect me if I'm the one who's taking it over? I'm not moving it to my child. Recently, I had a case where with Parent PLUS loans, we talk about, this is kind of morbid, but a die with your debt strategy. This is because just as we talk about with large student loan balances for graduate students, forgiveness can sometimes be the answer, especially if your balance is a lot greater than your annual income. And if you're someone with Parent PLUS loans, where that's the case now while you're working, then it's probably definitely going to be the case when you go to retire, where that balance will continue to stay greater than income. So we talk about a die with your debt strategy. And this is just like the forgiveness conversation we have, where we compare paying off the balance like a regular debt. We compare that to a forgiveness path to show the numbers to see what is more mathematically beneficial, lifestyle wise, financial planning wise, what is the better overall decision for you. And so, getting to the point, to the case, that was kind of an overview. I had a consultation last week where that was the recommendation, that we were going to be going on an income-driven plan, pursuing forgiveness going forward, and saving for the potential tax implication. And I oftentimes, well, not oftentimes, but sometimes with Parent Plus borrowers, that is a really difficult mindset to switch to, because, you know, in that generation, student loans were not like this. They were not as large of, you know, as balances as we see today. Debt was a very bad thing in their generation, where they were taught just to pay off debt like their hair is on fire. And so that conversation of pursuing forgiveness and treating the debt very passively is very uncomfortable. And I recognize that in our conversation. So we talked about that. We talked about just how mathematically, taking emotions out of it, mathematically, this would be better for this person, for their retirement, for their standard of living in retirement. And also, we talked about the possibility of the tax implication possibly disappearing. That is a very real possibility in the future if things change. It's already waived right now until 2026. So we'll see what happens. But I think things are generally trending in a good direction right now for student loan repayment. So we ended the call. That was the conversation. And then I got an email today. I was telling you about it, Sim, very long email about how just psychologically that might be really difficult for them to do. How do you kind of go about those conversations with your clients, Sim?
Yeah, that's really tough, because when I actually started in financial planning, I started as a paraplanner. And so my job was not to be client facing, but to come up with plans. So I'd create the plan, give it to my boss, and she'd present it. Well, then I, you know, graduated my way up and I started meeting with people, and it would always boggle my mind where I was like, oh, I'm talking to a person. Like, it's not just a simple like science of like, this is what you do for your retirement and you're done. That's why they call it like behavioral finance, right? Because you're talking to a person, you have to deal with their psychology. And so, you know, sometimes I in the past would try to like hedge a little bit, like, okay, maybe save more for this, so you don't have to do as much. It's difficult with student loans because usually I tell people don't hedge, either pay this thing off or go for forgiveness. We're not doing both. And mm-hmm. So, you know, we'll talk about what does your, in this case, what I maybe would have done, because I didn't meet with this guy, but our, and maybe you already talked with him about this, but what would your standard of living look like if you are paying this thing off? How much cash mm-hmm. flow would you have? What would you rather be doing with your cash flow? And sometimes I try to get them to articulate, like, what are your top three goals in life? And then is your spending in line with your goals? So for example, with like a lot of older folks, you might hear them say, well, I want to travel. I want to see the grandkids. I want to see the grandkids come out. Are your student loans holding you back from that? If you're paying off your student loans, does that mean you'll see your grandkids less? And sometimes kind of framing it in that sense is helpful, because then they're like, no, I would rather spend more on my family than on my student loans. Some people mm-hmm. are very debt averse, and when you kind of get down to it, they should pay off their loans because that's their goal and that's what they should do. As long as everyone is aware of their options and they're making the best decision in line with their goals. Because sometimes I find that a lot of people don't know what their goals are, which is maybe why they hire a financial planner in the first place to do that goal setting. But it's good to get them to articulate it.
No, that's a great point. And I think that's what I really love about financial planning and student loan planning, is that there is the math answer, but there's also like, I love how we can talk about so many options available. It doesn't have to be the math answer if psychologically, mentally, you are not going to be able to sleep at night going that route, because that's not good. That's not good for your health or for your well-being. So, you know, there's sometimes the math answer, sometimes the behavior answer. That's okay. And that's what makes finance personal. Personal finance is completely personal to your financial journey, you and your family's journey. And I think you said it great, where getting real clear on what your financial goals are and how you see your future, how you see your retirement, that can help us make better decisions when it comes to your student loan plan or your financial plan. So I was thinking of some things that I could come back with in my email back to this person, but I'm not, definitely not upset that he is maybe not interested in going the recommended route. Cause again, like that's just the math answer that I gave him. We'll want to go through maybe some pros and cons. And I always do this on calls too, like talking through pros and cons of which route means what, because it's not always, you know, everything is perfect going one direction and the other direction is all bad things. No, there's always pros and cons to both routes. So I think in this situation where you're thinking about retirement, thinking about trying to pay off this really big balance before retirement, the cons are, like you said, cash flow. What is that going to do to your cash flow? What does that mean for the next 10, 15 years for you? And how do you feel about that? How do you feel about committing that amount of money towards the student loans when it could be a different amount, just paying like the income-driven payment amount? Other cons, you know, to maybe going a more passive route is the time. It is potentially longer than maybe it would take to pay off the balance if you were being disciplined. And so this person was in their 60s. They would be looking at a 25-year timeline. So they would be older. And that mentally might be hard for him to be thinking about too, is, you know, well, this forgiveness path, if I go this route, I'll be in my, you know, ripe old 80s, almost 90s. But then other cons to going the more aggressive route is, what does that do to your retirement savings too? Because I think he was considering like using some of his retirement assets. So there's so many like things you want to consider, but that's definitely something we could talk through in our consultations and help someone make a good decision. And yeah, for this person, I think my hope is I'm just going to go back and try to make him feel as comfortable as possible with his decisions, lay out all the pros and cons again. I already sent him the podcast episode that Travis did. This was a couple years ago now, but it's episode 107 of the Student Loan Planner podcast, and it's called Fighting Debt with Weapons from the Last War. And I send this to anyone, this link to the podcast episode, I send this to anyone who has a hard time maybe thinking about the passive approach, because maybe they're kind of stuck on the traditional way to pay back debt. Because it's a really great overview of why the passive approach might make more sense, might make more financial sense than, you know, taking a very traditional approach. And the comparison there is, it's hard to fight student loans with, you know, swords from the last war, older wars, than it would be to blast it with something more nuclear potentially. So I don't know. He does a way better job. That's why I refer to this podcast episode. But
I'll have to listen to it. And, you know, I think what you're saying, Megan, is right. It's not just older folks. I talked to a lot of people where I'll recommend like do this 20 or 25 year path and they freak out. They're like, I'm going to have my loans for how long? One example I like to use, just maybe to reframe it, and I think I also got this from Travis, is to think of your student loan payment in that situation as just another tax you pay, right? You go to work, you pay your FICA taxes, your federal, your state, and now you have your student loan tax. And, you know, because you borrowed your student loans theoretically to give you a better quality of life so you can get the job that you have. So it's just another tax that will one day go away.
Well said. All right. Well, I think we had a lot of good content to chat about today. Questions from the inbox, questions from the Facebook groups, some recent case studies we've ran into. Anything you'd like to add before we hop off?
I like to tell this to all the people that I've met with, but if you've met with one of us and we, you know, came up with a plan for you to get your loans forgiven, can you email us when you do get your loans forgiven? Because I love to hear the positive stories. Like it just makes my day. Like I'm sitting there with you. Like I'm excited when you get your loans forgiven. So, you know, if you met with any of us, just let us know.
Yep. I tell folks that on my calls, like, hey, when this gets forgiven, send me an email. Like it always brightens up my day. And it does. Like you're exactly right. We're along for the journey. We're invested in the progress of your plan. So let us know. And if you're seeing weird stuff out there, like something interesting that you think could benefit the public to know, send us an email as well, help@studentloanplanner.com. We could pick that up, talk about it on the podcast episode next as well to maybe help more people if you're seeing something with your student loan situation that might be helpful to share with others. Thanks for hanging out with us today. And I hope you guys have a wonderful holiday season coming up, and we'll catch you on the next podcast.
Stay safe, everyone.